Foundation, where arts and education leaders can learn about how to bring the arts to more people. Downloads at the Knowledge Center at wallacefoundation.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. WILL programming is made possible by Strawberry Fields Natural Food Store, featuring locally grown and organic produce, freshly baked breads, a coffee bar, and bulk foods department. Strawberry Fields also offers natural vitamins, health and beauty products, household cleaning products, pet foods, and an in-store nutritionist to answer questions about healthy eating.
It's 106, and today's Afternoon Magazine comes from the archives. And as this is a taped program, we're not accepting phone calls today.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Sally Hemings. We know her name. She was a slave and the mistress of Thomas Jefferson. Who else was she? Well, she was the half-sister of Jefferson's wife. Sally Hemings bore Jefferson 7 children over the course of a relationship that lasted more than 3 decades. This afternoon, we're going to hear more about Sarah Hemings. Sally was her nickname. Her extended family, Jefferson and Monticello. Our guest is Annette Gordon Reed. She has had a long interest in Monticello, Jefferson, and Sally Hemings. Gordon Reed is the author of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, An American Controversy. That book examined how historians could have so long discounted the possibility of a relationship between the two. Now Gordon Reed has written a new book, the title, The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. This book traces the Hemings family over 3 generations and provides us with a new perspective on a story of America, a story Gordon Reed describes as one of, in her words, slavery, intertwined families, pain, loss, silence, denial, and endurance. Annette Gordon Reed is a professor of law at New York Law School and a professor of history at Rutgers University. Her new book, The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family, is published by W.W. Norton. Annette Gordon Reed, good afternoon. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Sure. What was your introduction to Sally Hemings? What led you to your interest in her?
Well, I first heard about Sally Hemings when I was about 12 years old, and I read a copy of my parents' book, White Over Black, by Winthrop Jordan, and there was a chapter in it called Thomas Jefferson, Self and Society, and it mentioned Sally Hemings. I'd been reading about Jefferson, sort of age-appropriate child biographies about Jefferson and Monticello from the time I was in the 3rd grade, but I didn't hear anything at all about the Hemingses in those books. It wasn't until I got to a real sort of mature history book that I first heard about the family, and I just found the story fascinating.
Yeah. Why has history been so slow to see Sally Hemings and her extended family as significant?
Well, I think there's an idea that history, a couple of schools of thought, that history is about the lives of great men, and mainly men and a few women, who are sort of movers and shakers in the world, you know, who pass laws and make constitutions and do things of that nature, and that those are the people who are sort of fit subjects for historical inquiry. It's only in recent decades that we've started to think more, sort of broaden the definition of who is an actor in history. And because Sally Hemings and her family were enslaved people, they didn't fit the bill as people who are actors, because obviously their lives were controlled by the people who owned them. And so it's only when we start to get a broader sense of what history is about, can you bring the lives, you know, they call it history from the bottom up, do you start to write about the lives of ordinary people and even people who are oppressed? So they're not movers and shakers in society, and so they weren't thought of as being important.
Yeah, but they are actors, aren't they?
Well, they're definitely actors within the limited ranges that were allowed to them. And I think that's what is particularly interesting, is how people who have so much against them, how they still manage or try within the confines of that to build the best lives for themselves that they could under the circumstances.
Hmm.
And that's an interesting, that has always interested me.
Yeah. And one of the very interesting figures in this story is Sally's mother,
mm-hmm.
Elizabeth. You say if one person could be brought forward to help tell this story, hers would be the most valuable voice.
Yes, because she would have known everybody.
Yeah.
You know, Jefferson, Jefferson's wife, Jefferson's wife's father, John Wales, who also fathered six of her children, including Sally Hemings. And she saw America go from a colony to the early republic. She died in 1807, born in 1735 and died in 1807, so she lived a long life. And she saw the country change quite a bit. And I would like to, it would be interesting to get her thoughts on all of these people that we're writing about.
Yeah. Now, who owned Elizabeth?
Elizabeth Hemings was born, when she was born, she was owned by a family called the Eppses, which is a very large, and well, an old family from Virginia. And when one of the Epps daughters married John Wales, who was an English immigrant, he came into ownership of Elizabeth Hemings when she was about 11 or 12 years old. And after his third wife died, he took Elizabeth Hemings as a concubine and had six children with her. And when he died, his daughter inherited the Hemings family, and so that's how they came to Monticello in 1774 and 1775. So it's a story of, you know, the movement of property when families married and people died, which were sort of life-changing events for enslaved people.
Yeah. At this time in the history of the colonies of the United States, were there many people of mixed race?
Yes, there were very many people of mixed race. We don't know precise numbers. We don't get blacks counted in the census until later, but certainly from reports, you can tell from reports of visitors from the North in particular who would come down to Virginia and just be astounded by the number of mixed-race children, mixed-race people whom they found there. And certainly some of the DNA studies that they're doing of blacks now show a pretty high rate of mixture that probably didn't happen in the 20th century, that most of this is a result of white males fathering children by black women. Although the first interracial marriages in the United States were between white women and black men early in the early 1700s. But afterwards, when slavery really begins to get going, the ratio switches, and it's much more, it's not a question of marriages, but it's a question of white males fathering children by black women.
Mm. Now, Mrs. Jefferson and Sally Hemings were half-sisters. Were they aware of that relationship?
It's hard to see how they could not be. I mean, Elizabeth Hemings was living at home. Excuse me, Martha Wales was living at home during the time that Elizabeth Hemings was having children with her father. There were six of them, and it'd be sort of difficult. They were considered the house slaves. They were people who worked in the home. It would be hard to imagine a woman not knowing that her father was having six kids with a woman living in their house. And also, the neighbors talked about this. People in the community, this was a story that wasn't just in their house. So if people outside of it knew, if enslaved people knew about it, Martha would have known about it as well. And certainly Jefferson's treatment of the Hemings family once they come to Monticello shows that he knew that there was a special connection between these people and his wife.
Mm. How did it affect Jefferson knowing that his wife was related to the Hemingses through John Wales?
Well, this is the only thing you can tell is how he, as I said, as I indicated before, a little bit alluded to before, you know, he treats them very differently. The Hemings males are allowed to go off and hire their own time and to keep their wages. The women don't have to go to the fields. At harvest time, everybody, no matter what your job was, you had to go out and help harvest the crop. The Hemings women did not do that. They were sort of constructed as sort of white women in a way, even though they were not white. But because of this connection between Jefferson's wife and these women, so it's their treatment. They're sort of a caste apart from other people, and he treats them more like lower class white servants than actual enslaved people. And in fact, the only people he frees sort of outright during the 1790s are Robert and James Hemings, who are the two eldest sons of John Wales.
Mm. You write early in the book, family was all to everyone, black and white, and this made life complicated as those enslaved and those who held them in bondage were related. Talk with us about that very complicated life.
Yes. Well, you think about a community where blood and kinship mean something. But what do you do when blood and race mean something as well? You know, there's black blood and white blood. And you mix those kinds of things. And some families, it didn't make any difference to them. I mean, some people had relatives and they sold relatives. They gave their relatives away as wedding presents. And some men didn't care and died without freeing their children. Some people did care because it would be sort of hard. It was harder for them to short-circuit this notion that being blood related to somebody mattered in some sense. Now, it didn't matter enough for him to say, okay, now all of you Hemingses are free. But it did matter to him and how he constructed their lives as enslaved people. And we have a tendency today to think, well, unless it, you know, results in the total freedom of everybody, then it doesn't make any difference. But it certainly, there's something in between that. And these people were cast in this sort of in-between role. And we can't know exactly how they felt about it. I mean, we have James and Robert. We know that the Hemings males were literate. James and Robert Hemings could read and write. All of Robert Hemings's correspondence with Jefferson is missing. So we don't get a sense of his voice in dealing with Jefferson. But there's clearly, from a lot of the stories and anecdotes and actions on the part of these people, a recognition that there's a connection here somehow that makes them different from other enslaved people on the plantation.
Hmm. Did the Jeffersons think of the Hemingses and other slaves as people?
Yes, I think they did. But they're thinking about them as people, different types of people, in the way that Jefferson and other people grouped women, children, and slaves in the same category, as people who had legal disabilities and who were supposed to be under, and he would say protection, we would say control of men. So this is a very hierarchical society here in many ways, and certainly slaves are at the bottom of the hierarchy. But it's difficult for us, we still have hierarchies today, but there it's they were used to putting people in rank order, and that the fact that they put them in some sort of order didn't mean that they didn't think that these people, that Jefferson didn't think that these people were, in fact, people, but they were people with these kinds of disabilities. And that's hard for us to, it's hard for me, for all of us to figure out exactly what's going on here. But there was a recognition of them being these people, but not a willingness to recognize their full humanity and to allow them to act as people like white men were people, essentially.
Yeah. Well, one of the things you write about here in this story is Martha Wales Jefferson and being within this marriage, not having any control over her body.
That's true. That's true. I mean, Jefferson couldn't sell Martha Wales. Although, I mean, you know, he couldn't put her up on an auction block and sell her, but she, as a wife, had to submit to him. And, in fact, she was never equipped to bear children, and in the end ends up dying as a result of complications from childbirth. I mean, every time she got pregnant, she was pretty much at death's door. And so you wonder, what is going on with that in a marriage where it's pretty clear that that pregnancy was killing her, but yet she was pregnant 6, maybe perhaps 7 times. She may have had a miscarriage during a 10-year marriage. So So slavery was the worst situation to be in. Black slavery, you know, chattel slavery is the worst situation to be in. But it was not all a great situation for married women either.
Besides Jefferson, who was at Martha's side when she died?
Well, apparently members of his family, her sisters and sister-in-law, and also enslaved people. It was common, not an uncommon thing, for slaves to be gathered around any time, you know, the master or mistress is dying, to be sort of the last, watch going on. And the Hemings women were, including Sally Hemings and her sisters, were around Martha's bedside when she was dying. And that, I have to, as I said, that was not an unusual thing, but it made sense for these women to be there because they were the people who were sort of looking after her and had been, you know, her maids and so forth while she was alive.
It must have been an amazing scene.
Amazing scene?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's hard to imagine what the feelings would be at that time. I mean, they're watching a woman who is their mistress, who is their legal owner, she and her husband. But by the same token, some of those women had, I mean, they shared a father with her. And you can't imagine, I mean, it's very difficult for me to imagine the kind of conflicting emotions that would be there. You know somebody and this person is dying, you would feel empathy with anyone losing their lives, but at the same time, there's this relationship between you, a legal relationship that is just untenable, you know? It's just, it's hard to wrap your mind around.
It sure is. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Annette Gordon Reed, author most recently of The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, how did Martha's death affect Jefferson?
Well, he was devastated by her death. The stories told about him is that he sort of just went into this period of, was almost in shock for a long period of time after her death, and decided to sort of get away from it all by accepting a commission to France. It had been offered to him a couple of times before, but he had been unable to take it because Martha was ill. And so he decided to get away from it all by going to France. And he takes James Hemings with him because he wants to have him taught to be a French chef. And he leaves his daughters at Eppington, which was his sister-in-law's home, his wife's half-sister, at their home in Eppington. And he sends Sally Hemings with his two youngest daughters to be sort of like the companion nurse to them. So it's the beginning of Jefferson's sort of exile from Monticello. She dies in 1782, and he's really not back at Monticello on any full-time basis until 1794, really. And then it's only 2 years, and he goes back into public life. But we tend to think of Jefferson at Monticello all the time. But in the 1780s through 1794, he's either in France, or then when he comes back, he immediately goes to work in the government. So it's really, it sends him away from his home for a very long time.
And how old was Sally when she embarked on this trip to Europe?
She was 14.
Yeah.
She was 14 years old, crossing the ocean with Jefferson's daughter, who was 9. They were supposed to have a chaperone, but that fell through, and Jefferson was so adamant about getting his daughter to him. The youngest daughter had died while she's with her aunt, and that was the impetus for Jefferson sending for his other daughter. So they crossed the Atlantic by themselves, obviously with a captain there, and stay with Abigail Adams a couple of weeks, and then travel on to Paris. So this was something of an adventure for a very young person, coming from the wilds of Virginia to London and then Paris.
Yeah, and arriving in Paris in 1787, her brother James was there. What had his life been like there in Paris since his arrival, and what was life looking like for her What one, you know, thinking of what, trying to get your mind around it, you know, what one wonders, what did she think was ahead for her?
Well, James Hemings had been going to various apprenticeships in France since the time he'd gotten there in 1784, and Jefferson had found a succession of places for him to train as a cook. And one place he was training with the cook in the kitchen of the Prince de Condé, who was a member of the royal family and had a famous estate that's still there, obviously Chantilly. That had, you know, I mean, we think of Monticello as grand, but this place had stables for like 258 horses. I mean, it was the big time French chateau. And so he is there apprenticing as a cook, learning to make regular dishes, but also pastry chef as well. And at some point he hires a tutor. Near the end of his apprenticeship, he hires a tutor to teach him proper French grammar. And this is, you know, I think a sense that, you know, he's beginning to think about staying there. You know, it doesn't make sense to work for 2 years and pay somebody for 2 years to learn French if you're going back to Virginia. So in France, James Hemings and Sally Hemings were free if they had petitioned. It was a formality merely to petition for your freedom, and they could have stayed. So when she gets there, we don't really know exactly what she's doing at first. Jefferson had a household staff. His daughters went off to boarding school for 6 days a week. Sally Hemings is sent off to, was inoculated for smallpox, so she goes off into the country for 40 days in isolation to undergo that procedure, and a pretty grueling thing, and then and is sort of attended to by a man who had been a doctor to King Louis the 15th, who eventually died of smallpox because he couldn't save him. I mean, there was no cure for that, and there's no cure now, as a matter of fact, although we have ways of keeping people alive, but they didn't then. And it's just this odd situation for this 14-year-old, and the 14 and then 15-year-old girl who is in this new society with the new languages and new experiences. She does, both of them are paid wages at the time, and paid, as I, you know, sort of figured out when I finally could sort of do the exchange rates and make comparisons, paid very well for people in their position. So she learns for the first time what it's like to be paid for your work. And you can kind of see how she thought about staying there, given all the things that were happening to her.
Yeah, what a liberating thing paid wages are.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. So eventually, Sally and Thomas Jefferson would come to an agreement. So she would stay with him, and it came to be called the treaty. I believe one of her
described it as a treaty. She decided at some point, and I don't believe that this is just her. I mean, I don't mean to be sexist, but I think her brother, who was 24 at this time, had been there for over 5 years. And had traveled freely and, as I said, you know, made contacts with people in the outside world, including his tutor, they decided that they were going to stay there. And Jefferson, by this time, she was pregnant by Jefferson, and she did not want to come back to America. Apparently, she was concerned about her children being enslaved because Virginia followed the rule partus sequitur ventrum, meaning birth follows the womb, namely, you are what your mother was. If your mother was born a slave and is a slave, then you are a slave. And she knew that if she went back to Virginia, any children she had would be slaves. And Jefferson promised her that if she came back, she would have a good life and her children would be free once they became adults. They would live with them, and then when they became adults, they would leave as free people. And so she came back. And once she's back in Virginia, of course, she's out of the protection of French law, and she's pretty much under Jefferson's control because she's back in Virginia where Virginia law obtained. So it was a big gamble on her part and her brother's part, too, to come back here. And that's the source of, you know, one of the mysteries about Sally Hemings is why she would come back here and why she would trust Jefferson with something that important.
Yeah. What can you tell us about feelings between the two of them? Was this...
Well, that's a tricky business,
yeah,
because, you know, we don't have any letters, and I'm of the opinion, even if you have letters, it's very hard to know what's going on between two people. The only thing I say in the book, and when people ask me about this, is that she did not have to come back here with him, and I think that there are, I can imagine, a host of reasons. Family, I mean, it's sort of hard to think of leaving your mother and your siblings and everybody behind. But you can say that she trusted him enough that he was going to do what he said he was going to do. And that's also a part of a problem that people have with her, the notion that because her son said she trusted him, and the term he uses is implicitly, she thought he was going to do what he said he was going to do. And she couldn't have known that as a 16-year-old. It worked out. I mean, he did, but, you know, that's not something she could have known at the time, and that's what makes it seem a very, very big risk on her part.
In the course of researching and writing this book, did your feelings about who Thomas Jefferson was change? Do you find him a sympathetic character?
Well, I don't think, no. I don't think my attitude about him changed so much as I just had the picture of him broadened a bit. Because when you think about him, as I said, he has primarily been my focus of inquiry. But when you think about him in relationship to this family, all of it makes much more sense. I mean, the typical thought is to say, you know, Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, as if there are these two people existing in this sort of binary relationship,
uh-huh,
and nobody's around them. But putting them in context, you know, he knew her brothers long before he knew her. I mean, had long associations with her brothers from the time they were, you know, her older brother, Robert Hemings, becomes Jefferson's manservant when he's 12 years old. And he's traveling around with Jefferson. He's with Jefferson in Philadelphia when he writes the Declaration. Jefferson makes more sense to me. His relationship with all of them make more sense to me once I see them all together acting, you know, in concert with one another, as opposed to just one-on-one Tom and Sally. So I don't think he's no more or less sympathetic to me. It's just that I have, a better understanding of what life at Monticello was like now that I, you know, have really gotten down to looking at a narrative instead of, you know, looking at other people's arguments about something.
Hmm. Well, talk with us a little bit about what role the Hemings played at Monticello in terms of life there. What were their contributions to life at Monticello?
Well, the first generation of Hemingses really serve pretty much as, you know, they are the servants to Jefferson and his wife. And then after she dies, the focus turns to Jefferson and his daughters. But the other generation of Hemings is people like John Hemings, who was Sally Hemings' younger half-brother, and Joseph Fawcett, who was her nephew. The next generation of Hemings has become artisans. They are people, I mean, John Hemings was a master carpenter and joiner at Monticello, and there are examples of his work at Monticello today that can be seen. They contributed to the look of Monticello. Joseph Fawcett did ironwork. He was a blacksmith and did metalwork and did lots of things, you know, at Monticello. So the next generation of people become, as I said, they're artisans. They're making things. They're doing things at Monticello, rather than just merely being the sort of close people to Jefferson. I mean, once Robert and James go away, Jefferson, the next person who sort of succeeds them is a man named Burl Colbert, who is also an Elizabeth Hemings grandson and Sally Hemings' nephew. He becomes Jefferson's closest sort of, you know, confidential servant is the word that Jefferson's grandson used, and he virtually went everywhere where Jefferson went. So there's still that element of the family that is sort of taking care of Jefferson personally, but there are other people who are making things and building his carriages and doing, you know, shoeing the horses. And Joseph Fawcett is head of the blacksmith shop, and he is allowed to work on his own time and keep his money and also take a percentage of the profits from the blacksmith shop. So they're making things and doing things. They're working with Jefferson as on sort of a professional basis. Jefferson was a woodworker himself. He built furniture, and he liked to spend a lot of time with his carpenters and doing various things, which would have included his sons because they were apprenticed to John Hemings. So they're meeting on a different level. It's not just servant to servant. It's sort of a professional artisan to artisan type of relationship.
Let's take a call now. A listener in Champaign on the line, ready to talk with Annette Gordon Reed, author of The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. Listener in Champaign, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Two things have been puzzling me for years. One is that a few years back there were some DNA studies that were suggesting that perhaps Sally Hemings was associated more with Jefferson's brother than with Jefferson.
Mm-hmm.
And then two, it's my understanding that Jefferson died essentially broke.
Mm-hmm.
What happened to Sally after that?
Mm-hmm. Okay, on the first question, the DNA tests were done to test the question whether Jefferson's, Sally Hemings' children were fathered by Jefferson or by a family called the Carrs. The Carr brothers were Jefferson's nephews, and the Jefferson family's explanation was, well, the reason all of Sally Hemings' children look like Thomas Jefferson is that they're the children of, you know, one of these Carr brother people. So the DNA test established that there was no connection between the Hemings descendant and the Carrs. It found a connection between the Hemingses and the Jefferson family. It was not a strict paternity test. So what it tells you is that the Hemings descendant who was tested is a Jefferson. So it's not about whether he was his brother or him. The question was it a Carr or Jefferson? And so now the DNA test just tells you that this person is a member of the Jefferson family. But if you take the DNA and add it to other information that we know about Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, most historians have come to the conclusion that it is Jefferson was the father of these children. So it's not the DNA alone. It's not the evidence alone. It's all of the things together. We don't have DNA proof that Jefferson was the father of anybody, not even his legal children. So the DNA is still something, it's an intervention that is sort of very, very rare in any circumstance. So you take the DNA and the other information, and that's what convinces people that Jefferson was the likely father of all of Sally Hemings' children. So it's the totality of the circumstances. What happens to Sally Hemings is after Jefferson dies, yes, he dies $107,000 in debt in 1826, which is millions of dollars in today's terms. Sally Hemings moves into Charlottesville with her two youngest sons, Madison and Eston, and they are formally freed. She is, what they say, given her time. That is to say, just go. If you freed a person, you couldn't free a slave above 45 in Virginia without detailing how you were going to take care of that person. You also had to petition the legislature to allow the person to remain in the state, or else they would be sold back into slavery after a year. So I say that I just think it would be impossible for Jefferson under those circumstances to put in a document, I'm freeing Sally Hemings. Everybody knew who Sally was. And this is how I'm going to take care of her and let her stay in the state. That would have been an admission that everything that people had been saying was true. And I don't think he would have done that to his white family. And he didn't. So what she does is she moves into town. There are two census records that confirm this. One from 1830. Where she's listed as a free white person, strangely enough, and then an 1833 census where she lists herself as a free mulatto who has lived in Charlottesville. She'd been there since 1826. So she is informally let go. the sons are formally freed, and he petitions the legislature to allow them to stay. The two older children had left Monticello as white people and moved to Washington. They didn't want free papers, because if you had, what would a white person be doing with free papers? So they just go off and live as white people. And so she dies in 1835. That's what we believe. We don't have any official record of that. Someone claims to have seen her in 1837, but we don't know. There's no way to verify that. Her son said she died. What he said, she died in 1835. Could have been a mistranscription or whatever. But she leaves Monticello in 1826 and is not a part of the auction that takes place 6 months later after Jefferson's death. And she lives, the family rents a house for a time, and then they buy a house, and she lives with her son Madison until her death.
Yeah. What became of the children who, there were seven children in all, three died in infancy, and then Beverly and Harriet, they were the two that went off and lived as whites, I believe, and then Madison and Esten. What became of these four children?
Well, the two older children, as I said, go off into whiteness, and we don't know where they are. I mean, they're always... you know, hints about who their identity and who they might have been. I mean, Harriet is especially problematic because she married somebody, and women, after you marry and you take somebody else's name, you disappear, really. I mean, in the records, in ways. It's very difficult to trace someone. I'm going to be doing a second volume of this, and I hope to try, it's like a needle in the haystack, but I like that kind of stuff, to try to figure out who these people are and where they went. Beverly, we have no real trace of him. We know that they got married. They married white people who may or not have known that they were part African-American. And Madison Hemings remains, and his younger brother, Esten, moved to Ohio. And both are in the black community there for a time. Esten, and we don't really know why, except that things began to deteriorate for African-American people in Ohio in the 1840s and 1850s. He moves to Wisconsin and takes the name Esten Hemings Jefferson, E.H. Jefferson, and his family turns white, decides to live in the white community. And his son, John Wales Jefferson, becomes, you know, first he's called Wales Hemings. Then he changed his name to John Wales Jefferson. He takes the name Jefferson. And so we know what happens to them because they live as white people later on. And they've moved to another state. And so I think they thought they were hiding themselves pretty well. They changed their family story, and they're no longer descended from Jefferson. Obviously, they can't say they're descended from Jefferson because that would mean they were part black, which is what they're trying to hide. And one of the things that I'm going to trace in the second book is the life of John Wales Jefferson, who becomes a very, very prosperous businessman, and sort of compare him to Madison Hemings' children who remain in the black community. And there are some distinguished people there. The first, Frederick Madison Roberts, becomes the first black member of the California state legislature. So it'll be interesting to see these two, and, you know, very, very noted civil rights activist and campaigner for black rights and so forth. So it's interesting to compare the two lines.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, I look forward to that book. The affair between Sally Hemings and Thomas Jefferson became well known during Jefferson's first presidency in 1802. It hit the papers. What kind of treatment did it receive in the press? What was the reaction from the public, and what was the impact for the Hemingses and the Jeffersons?
Well, it was sensationalized. I mean, the Federalists, Jefferson's opponents, sort of relished this kind of story. Anything that sort of embarrasses your opponent at the time, we think dirty campaigning happens only now. But it was pretty seriously, pretty vicious stuff about Sally Hemings and about Jefferson in the press. The public didn't seem to care. I mean, either they didn't believe it or they didn't care. I mean, Jefferson, in his first presidency, bought Louisiana. He doubled the size of the country. People were thinking about going west. People were thinking about what the president and what the government and what society, the new society, was going to be doing for them, you know, sort of bread and butter kinds of things. The idea that a man had a mistress or that a Southern slaveholder had a slave woman as a mistress, certainly below the Mason-Dixon line, wasn't a surprise. I mean, it wasn't something that was crazy to people or something that, we tend to think of people, the people in the 18th century and the early 19th century were not Victorians. They didn't think that sex was bad. They thought sex was a normal part of life. And the idea that a man would have a mistress wouldn't be odd to people. So Jefferson is resoundingly reelected in 1804. So in terms of the public either didn't believe the story or they didn't care because, you know, he was enormously popular after having bought Louisiana Territory. For the Jefferson family, the Hemingses, we don't really know what happened, how that affected their lives, except that a member of their family was being written about in the newspapers. I mean, she was, for a time, the most, if anybody said Sally in relationship to Thomas Jefferson, everybody knew what people were talking about. And so enslaved people knew about it, white people knew about it as well. There must have been a sense, and I can't tell this because I don't have their written reactions to this, but you could imagine that it would be a sense of how bizarre it would be to be talked about in this way, sort of caricatured in the way that she was caricatured in the press. Hmm.
At the close of the introduction, you say that there at Monticello, we can find the absolute best and the absolute worst that we have been as Americans. Mm-hmm. Why is this story important to us, and why, as you say, we should not get too far into the 21st century without looking back at the Hemingses and their time to remember and to learn?
Well, I think it's because it tells the stories of America's origins. I mean, this is not just political origins. We see the political origins of America in Jefferson's story, but also the racial origins of America in this story, and some of the problems that we've had trying to decide, who is an American and how various people fit into the American system. And I say the best that we've ever been, because Jefferson as a figure, as an Enlightenment figure, the author of the Declaration of Independence, the Statute on Religious Freedom, gives us really, really good things, right? Good ideas that people can take and use, as all useful ideas and useful inventions can be, taken far beyond their creator, whatever they had in mind. So that's what I mean by the best we've ever been. The worst, obviously, is slavery and chattel slavery and white supremacy and the notion that one race should predominate and rule over another. That's there as well. And so I think it's a way for us to think about our beginnings and in a way that can inform us about where we are today, and, particularly today when we're sort of we're in this sort of historic time,
mm-hmm.
When we have a man who is black, mixed race, who may become president, whether he does or not, even where he has been up until this point, is sort of, just amazing to be thinking about this at the time. There's certainly nothing, anything that was planned. But it's about our history, and it's such a deep part of our history that we sometimes overlook that I think it's important for us to examine it.
Yeah. What are your thoughts about our current discussion about America, race, and racial identity?
Well, gosh, the past couple of weeks have been kind of rough.
Yeah.
I had a friend who was out in Ohio who was doing some campaigning, and he was just stunned. This is a young white man, stunned by the openness with which people express the view that they can't vote for a black person, as if he's going to become president and become a dictator and round up all the white people. It's very, very odd, very, very odd, and somewhat disconcerting. We've come a long way for us to be at the point where we can have a nominee in this position. But there's a long way to go from some of the things that have been happening in the past couple of weeks and some of the reports I'm getting from people. So it's a mixed bag, a very mixed bag.
Yeah. There we'll leave it. Annette Gordon-Reed, thank you very much for talking with us this
afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Annette Gordon-Reed is the author of The Hemingses of Monticello, An American Family. The publisher is W.W. Norton.
And this program is from the AM 580 archives from last October 14th. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices are now in from the commodity exchanges. Here with the grain prices, AM 580's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much. Let's take a look at those numbers, Tom, as they settled in Chicago on a wintry Tuesday afternoon. Futures were higher in the wheat, the corn, and the soybean pits. We'll start with the wheat March contract, a 575.25 settlement price for the soft red, the high at 81, the low at 53, a settlement price at $5.75.25, up 6.25 cents. May futures, 593.25, the high, the low at 567. Settled at $5.87.75, up 6.25 on the afternoon. And July wheat, the harvest month, $6.03.25, the high, the low at $5.77.5. Settlement price, $5.98.25, up 4.75. September futures, $6.23, the high, the low at $6.5. Settled $6.19.25, up 5.5 cents. From Kansas City, where they trade the hard red, $5.94. up 4.75 cents for the day. But the spring wheat was 5.75 cents lower in the nearby March at $6.25.25 on the settlement price. From Chicago, corn pit now, nearby March contract, $3.94.75 the settlement price, up 13. The lead option had a high of $3.95, a low at $3.77.75, and a settlement price at $3.94.75. up 13 cents for the March corn. May contract up 13 as well. 405.25, the high, the low at 388.5. Settlement price at $4.05, up 13 cents for May corn. July, 415.25, the high, the low at 399. That contract settled at $4.15.25, up 12.75. And September futures, 425.25, the high, low at 413. Settlement price at 425.5, up 12.75. December corn today, 439.75. The high, the low at 23.25. Settlement price at $4.39.75, up 12.75. Related products in the outside markets. Crude oil trading the February contract at $39.40 a barrel is down 51 cents. January ethanol at $1.55.09, unchanged on the afternoon. Here's the way the soy complex finished up. Nearby January beans, 901.25 the high, the low at 877.75. And a settlement price at $9 a penny, up 14.5 cents for the January beans. March, 905 on the high, the low at $8.81.75, settled at $9.05, up 14.5. And the May futures up 14.5 as well, 916.25 the high, low at 893.5, settlement price $9.16, 14.5 cents for the May beans. July futures 928 the high, the low at $9.04, settled 927, up 14.5, and the November 928.75 the high, the low at 907.5, settlement price at 928.75, 12.5 cents higher. January bean meal futures 281 the high, the low at 271.90, settlement price at $281.40 a ton, up $5.90. The March futures 281 the high, the low at 271.30, settlement price 280.50, up 5.60. January bean oil 31.22 the high, the low at 30.55, settlement price at 31.21, up 27. And the March contract 31.55 the high, the low at 30.90. Settlement price at $31.52, up 27 on the afternoon. I'll return at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time. That's just about 11 minutes away. Now today, we'll talk with Mike Wolverton. He's at K-State in Manhattan, Kansas, about the agricultural energy markets. We'll see how much pressure the ethanol market is under as the price of crude oil has crashed over the last couple of weeks. Again, that current trade on crude oil is down at $39.40, 51 cents lower on the day. Happens during the closing mark report at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time. Recapping the numbers from the Chicago Board of Trade, futures finished the corn 13 higher, beans up 14, and wheat up 4 to 6 cents. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
Now, the settlement prices from the livestock exchange in Chicago, the Mercantile Exchange, the trend generally was up today aside from pork bellies. The nearby contract there finished the limit down. Live cattle for December had a high today of 85.95, the low 85.45. The settlement, 85.65. That's down 32.5. That's the only down contract in cattle today. February live cattle had a high of 87, the low 86.15. Settlement, 86.95, up 70. April live cattle, the high 89.65, the low 88.90. Settlement price, 89.50, up 67.5. And June live cattle had a high today of 85.60, the low 85.15, and the settlement price was 85.47.5, up 45. To the feeder cattle, the January contract had a high of 94.07.5, the low 93.55. Settlement price, 93.60, up 22.5. For March, the high was 93.50, the low 93 even. 93.37.5 was the settlement, up 45. April feeders had a high of 94.50, the low of 94.10, settlement 94.40, up 32.5 cents, and the May contract had a high of 95.20, the low 94.80, settled at the high 95.20, up 40. Lean hogs for February had a high of 61.45, the low 60.60, settlement price 61.20, up 30 on the day. April lean hogs, 69.22.5 the high, the low 68.50, settlement 68.82.5, up 12.5. May lean hogs at a high of 78.70, the low 77.60, settled at 78.60, up 50. And June at a high of 79.50, the low 78.45, settlement price 79.20, up 27.5. Pork bellies for February had a high today of 91.30, a low of 88.70. That's where they settled, down the $3 limit at 88.70. March had a high of 89.60, the low 86.60, and the settlement price 86.60, the low again, also down 250 on the day. Those are the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. It's 2 minutes before 2 o'clock. Our forecast calls for a winter weather advisory in effect for Champaign and vicinity until noon on Wednesday, a little bit earlier and 6 o'clock Wednesday morning for some of the southern counties in the AM 580 severe weather coverage area, but anywhere from Champaign, Vermilion, Piatt on north. It's a little bit longer. Sleet and freezing rain is in our forecast for the rest of the afternoon, and the roads are quite slick. We've gotten some reports from I-72 and a couple of other places that there's a lot of ice caused by freezing rain on the roadway, so do take it easy. There is one closing, early closing, to report. Rantoul Public Library is closing at 3 o'clock this afternoon. Again, the early closing, 3 o'clock for the Rantoul Public Library. Forecast calls for sleet and freezing rain, accumulations of sleet and snow in the Champaign-Urbana area of around an inch, the high of around 30. We're at 29 now. South winds 15 to 30 miles an hour, so it'll be blowing around as well. For the rest of the afternoon, periods of snow up north, 2 to 4 inches of accumulation likely up there. In central sections, sleet and freezing rain up to an inch accumulation. In the south, some mixed precipitation as well, freezing rain changing over to rain. For tonight, periods of snow in the north again, some sleet mixing in at times. In central sections, freezing rain and sleet changing to rain from south to north, and then periods of rain overnight in the south. And temperatures will be fairly steady, slowly rising. They'll take place this evening, the low temperatures ranging from 25 in the north to 42 in the south, and then up a little bit toward tomorrow morning. Periods of snow tomorrow in northern and northwest Illinois with some additional accumulation likely. Elsewhere, rain likely in the morning, then turning to snow showers and flurries in the afternoon with no accumulation on Christmas Eve. High temperatures tomorrow up from 30 in the north to 50 in the south, and those will take place early on in the day. The high in Champaign-Urbana tomorrow, 38, with a chance of rain in the morning, then some snow showers or flurries in the afternoon, and a shift in the wind from the southwest to out of the northwest. Becoming partly cloudy and clear tomorrow night, the Christmas Eve low 18 degrees, and then Christmas Day partly to mostly cloudy and a high of 32. Thursday night, cloudy, some light freezing rain possible late, the low 28, temperatures rising toward morning again, up to a high of 48 for the day after.